This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
What we thought we would do is each talk for 5 to 10 minutes, maybe me more generally on body art, because that I think is our brief tonight, to certainly talk about Nietzsche, but also talk about other figures. I know less about the Viennese actionists than Bridget, so I think she might concentrate there, and we will go back and forth a little bit and then open it up to you all. Does that sound okay? So I don't know, you know, if we're all on the same page, but I just wanted to lay out a few very basic terms. And I'm sorry in advance if this is too prosaic for some of you, most of you. I will focus on a few American figures. Just as a basic definition of body art first, there's the critic Willoughby Sharp in 1970 defined body art as art which uses the body as both the subject and the object of the work. Now, in the American context, I think there are three models of performance artists that emerged in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And again, we can test how appropriate they are for the Viennese context. First, performance as action has developed out of abstract expressionist painting, especially Pollock, of course, in the inner art activities of happenings, fluxes, and related movements. Second, the performance as task, perhaps an egalitarian model elaborated at the Judson Dance Theater in New York, in which everyday bodily routines, non-metaphorical movements like walking, running, were substituted for symbolic dance steps. And third, performance as ritual, and this is where we intersect. The American moment does with the Viennese moment, different versions of which were proposed also by Beuys, again, the Viennese actionists, and maybe even practitioners of destruction art like Gustav Metzger and Raphael Ortiz. Now, my sense is that most task performance wanted to demystify art. That was part of that project of the 1960s. Most ritualistic performance sought to remythify it, indeed to re-sacralize it. There's no way entirely to separate these three models, but I think that there are important differences, and I just want to zoom in on three representatives just to provide a typology. This is very schematic and very quick. For action performance, I'll use Carolee Schneemann. Born in 1939. For me, she was the first, again, in the American context, to extend the action model of performance into body art in the early 1960s. Her use of flesh as material, this is her phrase, to move from the perceptual interests of the time first to erotic expressions, then to feminist commitments, in a way that was soon shared by an entire generation of women artists. For his part, in the late 1960s, Acconci, who's my representative of the task model, Vito Acconci, turned the task model of performance into a testing of body and self alike, first in almost quasi-scientific isolation, then in intersubjective situations. In doing so, he opened up task performance to a body art that was a social theater of the psyche as well. Finally, in the early 1970s, Chris Burden will be my American representative of the ritual model. I think he also used the task model performance. He pushed them to produce a sacrificial form of performance art, although in a way that's perhaps less literal than the Viennese actionists. Now, just a few remarks on each of these three, and then I wanted to make a general claim about body art in this country as such. In her early notes, 1962-63, Schneemann drew on the phenomenological notions of body perception that had begun to circulate in her milieu in New York. So when she introduced her own body, nude body, into her painting constructions, she did so less for sexual titillation than what she called empathetic kinesthetic vitality. And here I have in mind fairly well-known works like Eye Bodies, 1963-64, which was her first piece of body art. It consisted of private actions documented in photographs that were performed in an environment of painted panels, mirrors, and umbrellas. Covered in paint, grease, chalk, ropes, plastic, she wrote, I established my body as visual territory. Not only am I an image maker, but I explore the image value of flesh as material. So the title of this piece was programmatic. Schneemann wanted her visual dramas, she called them, to provide for an intensification of all faculties simultaneously. And Eye Body did extend the eye of painting into the body of performance. She then went on, more famously, to do Meet Joy, which was performed first in Paris and in London, New York in 1964, which presented the body as fully, she says, erotic, sexual, desire, desiring. And I think many of you know, perhaps most, that it was a performance of a group of near-naked men and women cavorted along with any participants from the audience in a set of wet paint, plastic, and rope spiced with pieces of raw meat, fish, and chicken. And you can tell the title signals the move from Eye Body, a move beyond a phenomenological extension of painting to performance. Mijoy proposed an ecstatic reconfiguration of the solitary meat of the body and the communal joy of sex. Now, Conchi is maybe more familiar to us all. He first experimented with concrete poetry, but by 1969, he shifted to a task model of performance, which he adapted into performance tests, is his phrase, documented for an art public first through reports and photographs, and later through films and videos. Like the related performances of Bruce Nauman, Conchi subjected the body to apparently rational regimes for apparently irrational purposes. One example might be Step Piece of 1970, which he mounted an 18-inch stool in his apartment each morning at a rate of 30 steps a minute until he was exhausted. His stamina increased over the duration of the performance, but so did the absurdity of the tasks. And his adaption studies, also of 1970, tilted these tests further toward failure. One piece, my favorite actually, a blindfolded Conchi was thrown a rubber ball again and again. Another piece, he plunged his hand in his own mouth, also in repeated fashion until he choked. So these performances did test the reflexes of his body, but more, they aggravated its incompetencies to the point where an aggressivity against the self came to predominate in his work. He went on then, as you know, to do works like Trademarks, in which he turned his body into a graphic medium of indentations. He would bite into his flesh and then mark it, a kind of autographic mark pushed to a limit, but one in which self-possession and self-alienation were hard to tell apart. It was a way in which he was both active subject and passive object. I think this became kind of the important dynamic of his work, this set of imbrications of subject and object, self and other, privacy and publicity. And you know that he, in some pieces, would follow people around New York, Trust and Violation, a piece of 1971 called Claim, again, a fairly famous work. He actually invited people to encounter him in a basement in Soho, blindfolded. He was armed with, you know, crowbar and such. So it really kind of tested the limits in all kinds of registers. But when these limits were broken, there was a performance in 1973 in which, in a story of seduction, a young woman actually came up on the stage and kissed him. Akanshi backed away. I mean, his real taste for the transgression of these limits was minimal. Chris Burden, on the other hand, who really pushed the ritual model, the task model towards ritual, this crossing of these lines, I think in a way constituted his practice. And I think in many ways his works are perhaps too familiar even to rehearse. And you all know about Shute, when he had in 1971, he hired a friend as a marksman to shoot him in the arm, his left bicep was grazed, or Transfixed, which is perhaps closer to Nietzsche, in 1974. Burden was nailed with his arms extended a la Christ under the hood of his Volkswagen Beetle. The ritualistic dimension there was almost made evident. He called the traces, the remnants of these actions, relics. At this point, the term that I threw out at first, you know, body art is art that uses the body as both subject and object, seems innocent. But it was really this innocence or this immediacy of body art that I think we should hold on to it, because it's really this, I think, that attracted practitioners and impressed viewers in the first place. It is also, I think, what made body art a desperate, perhaps last response to the modernist mandate to make an art of simple materiality, to pursue an ideal of sheer presence after this ideal was hopeless in a way. Body art did not render subject and object one. On the contrary, especially in Akanshi, I think, it exacerbated this polarity and set up other binarisms as well. And the body is active or passive, body art is expressive, even liberatory, as evident still in Schneemann, or withdrawn, even debilitated, as it is often in Akanshi, and even more so, perhaps with Burden, and perhaps always with a figure like Bruce Nauman. But for me, the definitive ambiguity of body art, at least in this context, in this country, is this. Even though it was regarded as an art of presence, positively as an avant-gardist reuniting of art and life, its last gasp of presence, negatively as a nihilistic obliterating of aesthetic distance, it was also a marking of the body as a representation, as a sign, indeed as a semiotic field. And for me, perhaps the crux of body art, again, in this context, is this difficult shuttling between presence and representation, or more exactly, between the indexical markings of the real, this arm bitten or shot right now before your eyes, you have to be there to see it, and grandiose invocations of the symbolic, especially evident, of course, in ritualistic performances. So for me, this ambiguity of the body as both natural flesh and cultural artifact is crucial to body art. Maybe it's irreducible to all of us, and body art only confronts us with the ambivalence of this condition. It's a little essential for me, but I'll just risk it. But body art also, I think, complicates this ambiguity with another ambiguity, and this interests me even more. For it not only presents the body as a mark thing, but also invokes it as a psychic sight. For the most part, I think body art preceded the psychoanalytic engagements, again, in this country, first prompted by feminism and feminist art in the mid-1970s. When its models of subjectivity were not phenomenological, they tended to be behavioral, even sociological. Nonetheless, its involvement in subject-object relations led it toward an abstract theater of psychological or psychosexual positions. And often it seemed almost as if body art wanted to diagram the Freudian couplets of narcissism and aggressivity, voyeurism and exhibitionism, sadism and masochism. Indeed, to play out these vicissitudes of the instincts, the constant reversals of active and passive positions, the perpetual turnings round from subject to object and back again. In this way, body art anticipated rather than illustrated, I think, the psychoanalytic theories of subjectivity and the political critiques of power that became prominent from the late 1970s onward. This is not to say, I know my minutes are up, but this is just where I will end, that all body artists are voyeurs or exhibitionists, sadists or masochists. Danger and pain are my catalyst, Burden, remarked in 1974, not perverse pleasures for the body artist as such. So perhaps a model that uncouples such psychosexual positions is more pertinent here. And here, Deleuze is helpful. I don't usually turn to him, everyone else does, but I do right now, because I think he, in his theory of masochism, the way that he detached masochism from sadism, and highlights in his theory the contractual character of the masochistic relationship, might be useful here. The masochist, in his account, and I think he's right here, is the one who, in control in the in that contractual relationship. So such a contractual model of intersubjectivity is suggestive for me for body art. To the extent that body art follows the apparent default of the traditional mediums of art after minimalism and participates, and I think in the crisis of the artist, the crisis of the viewer too at this time, its posings of situations of contract and violation between self and other artists and audience might be seen as an attempt to declare as well as to compensate the loss of artistic conventions at that moment, indeed the loss of social conventions too. In other words, I don't have a liberatory view of body art. For me, it's a fairly desperate category. Of course, body art is usually seen to attest to the exact opposite condition, not to the loss of such conventions, but to the oppressive presence of aesthetic and social codes. So which is it? And this is, for me, the crucial question of body art, finally. Do the extreme markings of the body reiterate critically our bondage to society, to the symbolic order, or do they make them, they attempt to make them visible again? Like so many tattoos, perhaps, these inscriptions of artistic and social laws that seem, but perhaps only seem, to have faded away. For me, that's the kind of the hub of the question, at least for body art in this country. So with that, your turn.
our idea was that, I'm on, that we would each do a kind of introductory set of remarks, mine are less formalized than Hal's, and then have our discussion. I'm tempted to read, and I think I will actually, read a very brief passage from Jean Delillo's The Body Artist, which I think, for those of you who know the book, it's the beginning of the last chapter. And for those of you who don't, it is the thoughts, Delillo's depiction of the thoughts of a character named Lauren Hartke, who is the body artist, who is at this moment returning to the home that has been the site of her development of a particular and particularly possessing performance. Her performances being kinds of mimetic impersonations of others. And I want to then talk a little bit about the status of imitation and representation in Nietzsche, with the understanding that the body as a site opposed to metaphor and opposed in particular to the metaphors of language is a sort of problematic crux in Nietzsche's work in ways that I want to try and specify a little bit historically. But the line, in fact, it's one sentence and one paragraph from Delillo is this: "The dead squirrel you see in the driveway, dead and decapitated, turns out to be a strip of curled burlap. But you look at it, you walk past it, even so, with a mixed tinge of terror and pity. In some sense, that line captures at once, I think, the significance of Nietzsche's work and the powerful force of its effects, and some of its problems as a kind of acting out of a certain kind of aesthetic theory. In other words, what happens in this line is this woman who's accustomed to using her body as the site of imitation sees what she thinks is a dead, decapitated squirrel. And it's more than what she thinks, right? Because the line is, the dead squirrel you see in the driveway, dead and decapitated, turns out to be a strip of curled burlap. So in a sense, within DeLillo's sentence, the squirrel is no less a squirrel, dead and decapitated, for its turning out to be a strip of curled burlap, because in effect, that's what she has seen it as. In other words, for the body artist, who is someone who also rejects language as form of mediation for performance, and instead does all of her work through sheer embodiment, the status of her recognition, the status of what she sees, holds, even at that moment when the object is revealed to be, through further analysis, something else. And what it turns out to be is, for our purposes, I think, interestingly, and I think it also, I think it's surely deliberate, is a kind of material that is also ordinarily a surface for art and for representation. In other words, a strip of curled burlap. But you look at it, you walk past it, even so, with a mixed tinge of terror and pity. Terror and pity, of course, are the emotions of catharsis, and very particularly here, a kind of return on the part of the body artist to, we don't quite know which in DeLillo's book, a capacity to be taken in by, a willingness to see the world as a kind of stage for objects that provide occasions for a catharsis. It may be that. It may be a kind of return to the possibility of being taken in, or it may be a return actually to the possibility of having some more direct relation to the world. In other words, the mistake here of thinking that she sees something real, something really animal, where what she sees is a piece of curled burlap, is something like an empty surface for representation, ends up in the last lines of the book, if we're to take them seriously, being the beginning of her return to feeling the presence of the world. So the last thing she does in the book is open a window in order to feel the sort of salty air of the seaside air hit her face. So in the end of the book, then another literary metaphor, the metaphor of the window, which is also keyed to various metaphorics of representation, pictures as windows here, the curled burlap surface on the ground, at the end, the window. I think that, I bring this up here because the idea of the body in Nietzsche as a site, a surface, a place of being, deliberately opposed to language and to the metaphors of language and to the sort of everydayness and pragmatics of our use of language is central. And it comes out of, or sort of arose in a context in Vienna where there had been in Viennese literature of the 1950s an interrogation of everyday language and a rejection of the sort of transactional and communicative language of ordinary life, precisely because our habitual uses, because the habitual uses of language in everyday life were seen to be sort of routinely tainted with what have been called sort of microfascisms, right? Microfascisms of various kinds of propositional and authoritarian speech. So this is something that preoccupies Austrian literature at least through through the late 1980s in the work of Thomas Bernhard. In particular, for the poets of the Vienna group, Oswald Wiener, Karl-Hans Artmann, Wiener being a figure who was really important for the Viennese actionists, one of the things that they sought to do was to insist on the materiality of language and on its particular embeddedness in transactional and communicative uses and all that that brought with it in terms of the historical implications of ways in which language could be used. And so when they began to make poems out of individual words or poems that were presented pictographically, there was this wish to, on the one hand, acknowledge what Wiener called language as the style of reality, language as that which mediates our access to reality. So a rejection of the idea that somehow reality is ontologically given, and an insistence on language's mediating function, and a critique of everyday uses of language and the ways in which that language is open to historical contamination, compromise, and so forth. And by the late 50s, the Vienna group has moved into a kind of performance. So out of various kinds of concrete and phonetic poetry into doing sorts of cafe performances, and in particular a commitment to what Karl-Hans Artmann called acting poetically. So there is, that's part of the link to the kinds of performance that you see in the 60s art context in Vienna, this idea that one of the ways to repudiate language as compromised in ordinary life is to devise ways of acting poetically that assert the particular materiality of words and our capacities to use them in ways that will alter their histories. It's very striking in Nietzsche's corpus. He has written a lot, but the performances, unless I'm mistaken, are completely free of words. Is that right, Aaron, at least? In fact, I understand the opening moments of the performances, the later performances, so from the mid-60s on, the later performances that use other people, people other than Nietzsche, whereby someone is undressed, is sort of ritually disrobed, as staging or marking a kind of removal or extraction of the body from language and from contemporaneity. So the body is literally stripped of those things, literally garments, that indicate, right, that sort of signify our belonging to a particular time, to belonging to the present. And so it's this kind of initiation and an insertion of the body into the ritual space of Nietzsche's performance. But there's a sense in which the claim that Nietzsche then implicitly goes on to make in his work is a claim for, on the one hand, for the primacy of the body. That's the suggestion, right? That the body is the source, human bodies, animal bodies, the source and the site of all art that he as he makes it. So the innards, the blood, and so forth. And that originariness of the body with regard to art and with regard to the kind of sociability of the later actions represents a kind of extreme rejection of the metaphors of language and their codedness with regard to contemporary life, and a kind of cleansing return to ritual that takes us notionally entirely outside of the problematics of the historical modernity in which the works are produced. And this becomes, I think, especially marked when he acquires a ritual site where this happens. I'll say in just a minute how I think it's different when he's doing his first performances in Vienna and actually throughout the 60s around the world. I think there's a kind of implicit acknowledgement of the linguistically discursive there that disappears increasingly. One of the other things that Nietzsche's work is connected to, importantly, is early 20th century Vienna. So some of the skepticism about language that you see in 1950s Viennese literature connects back to the origins of certain kind of skepticism that was prominent in the work of Ludwig Wittgenstein. And also a kind of, what we see in Nietzsche, a return to and an interest in psychoanalysis and the idea of using art and performance as occasions for abreaction, right? As a kind of therapy to facilitate people's adjustment to the circumstances in which they live, and a kind of ridding of symptoms by means of exposure. But there's also a real connection to early 20th century expressionist painting as it was produced in Vienna in particular. And one way I would sort of key that connection would be to have us try and think about how when Nietzsche uses the body as an originary site of art and an originary site of the possibility of relation to others and imitation, he verges on producing, he stages by means of action something that approximates or imitates the production of works not made by human hands, at the very origin and model of which is what's known as the Veronica, the sudarium on which Christ's face miraculously appeared. Right, it's a handkerchief which is given to him by Veronica on the road to Calvary, and when he wipes his face with it and returns it to Veronica with his sweat and blood on it, his image appears in it, and this is the originary image which is used consistently to justify the production of any art at all. There is some sense in which when Nietzsche marks the body with blood and paint and then leaves its traces, the traces of that paint, on white surfaces, he's producing something that is understood to be analogous with a kind of divine production of art. Again, another gesture, another attempt to link the production of art to bodies as if miraculously and non-discursively. So in that instance, there's a kind of chain all the way back to the idea that the miraculous production of the Veronica is also like the miraculous production of Christ. In other words, the human being produced without semen and the image produced not by human hands. So Nietzsche is playing around with all kinds of points of reference in the history of art around the question of the possible origins of works of art in the body as a way of trying to find a source for art that would be anti-metaphorical, non-discursive, that would be possessed of a kind of presence and immediacy. One of the things that's very striking about the early performances is that exactly that attempt to produce performances and real events was made with a clear and, I think, really intelligent awareness of what would be made of those performances discursively in newspapers and disciplinarily by the police. So in the early works, there's an enormous importance of the context of early 60s Vienna, and then late 60s London, various places where there were police interventions in Nietzsche's performances. So while language is banished from the site of these productions, and while there's a kind of conceit of anti-metaphoricalness, there's nonetheless, at least in the early work, a very clear understanding of the conditions of publicity that existed in the early 1960s. And that has obviously changed a lot by now. I mean, Aaron told me that the is it shot on video or shot on film? In any case, the images that were playing on the large screen, the piece that was playing on the large screen in the front room, which was made in 1998 of the 100th performance, was shown on Austrian national television. And you can see, even on the margins of the performance in the later films and videos, how much a very different kind of audience has been incorporated into the stagings of these events. And I think that transformation in what the public sphere's relation is to Nietzsche's production is actually something that goes to the heart of what the work is, and that goes actually unacknowledged. I mean, the practices go largely untransformed. For me, that's something of interest, but also a little bit strange. And I feel a sense of insufficiency about it, that the practices remain so continuous. And it's as though the work was, at a certain point, came to be understood to be totally available for a very different kind of spectatorship than it originally anticipated. So those are some of the things that I wanted to toss out there around the whole sort of problematic of representation and presence in Nietzsche and related things.
Can I ask you a question or two?
No.
No? Okay, never mind. And then we want to draw you all in. As I listened to you talk, it seemed to me that one way to think about the actionists, if not Nietzsche in particular, is in terms of, you know, let's say four forces. I mean, there is the problem, maybe you didn't mention this as much, of the avant-garde, the neo-avant-garde, you know, what to do in the immediate post-war period mm-hmm. with the avant-garde legacy, especially with the evidence of the performative and other sites. But right on top of this question is the predicament of the change in public space that you mentioned, you know, the fact of spectacle, that the performative quickly spins into the theatrical. The sacrificial cannot be profoundly recreated. It looks like kind of a kitschy theater, kitschy mm-hmm. spectacle. So, and that seems to be a kind of a set of questions, a set of predicaments. But then the other forces seem historical. You mentioned Viennese Expressionism, Freud, and figures like Wittgenstein, Loos, the dialectic of you know, repression and its mm-hmm. counter. You know, I feel in a way less Freud in all this work than other figures.
Reich.
Yeah. And our toes in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure how or where. And then as another historical force to contend with, Austrian fascism. I mean, you specified it in terms of language, and I think that's clearly right, the desire to purge, just get rid of language that seems to encode within it, you know, fascist protocols, and other figures in that epoch dealt with it in different ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, France, it's, you know, Blanche writing, you know, drain it of any ideological significance, as if that were possible. But clearly that the, you know, fascism is there countered in the kind of figure of the open body. I mean, is there not a sense, too, that it's not just language, but some sense of a, I mean, this comes obviously later through figures like Klaus Tevelite, but of a armored body ego that cannot contend, or is said not to be able to contend with this realm of the perverse, the polymorph perverse, mm-hmm. This kind of excremental realm that was also horrific to figures like Loos. I mean, I think Gunter Bruce and Otto Muhl did a performance in 1964 titled Ornament is a Crime, There's a way in which, well, for Lewis, the ornamental was really the excremental, and he objected it, but it's a, in a way precisely where these figures are drawn, you know. So it's, anyway, I just wanted to ask you about those terms, and if you could say more maybe about the specificity of fascism in Austria and how that's treated in actionism.
Well, I think, I think in Nietzsche, it's largely tabled. It's largely a kind of imagined return and recuperation of ritual, as if untainted by fascism, because untainted by modernity, because removed from modernity. I tend to think that the complete absence of language in this is a major facilitator, because it is in so much of the literature of the period, there is this kind of intense micro focus on language as the site of certain kinds of latently or micro fascist enactments. And I do think, this is not at all a site of expertise for me, but to give one example, in Austrian culture, language is such a site for this. If you think about it, there's a certain understanding that language was used in particular ways to evade and justify what had happened in Austria with regard to the Third Reich and with regard to Nazism. So there's a particular critique, if you take the term Anschluss, right, or annexation, that's understood, that would be a kind of key term for a skepticism about language, a politically nuanced skepticism about language in post-war Austria that would say, well, the Anschluss was no Anschluss at all, right? To call it an Anschluss is to disavow all of the native interest in and commitment to fascism that had laid the groundwork for the annexation of Austria. And so, in a sort of cultural literary historian of Austria could say much more about this. I do have the sense that with Nietzsche there's a kind of a wish to sort of take that off the table, and it takes that off the table, and taking language off the table allows for returns to expressionism, allows for a return to also a kind of deliberately crude application of psychoanalytic principles, right, in the abreaction play those kinds of rituals that he performs, right, as if symptoms can be lifted in ways that had sort of ceased to have currency in psychoanalysis essentially after the First World War, right, by kinds of material exposure. And there's an interest in a kind of wish that it could be like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the interest of the work, but it's also a site of a kind of mistrust that I have of the work. One of the moments that I find myself fascinated with, and the things that are on display here, is that in that film of the 100th performance, there was a film that was playing here of an even more recent 2004 performance, which is the only occasion, is it that right, Aaron, the only occasion, at least on the materials that you're showing, where one of the people involved in the performance actually resists. Is it the only one? Did Nietzsche say? Right. One doesn't know. I'm talking about the sort of documents. For all I know, they're like running, tails between their legs all the time out of Krinzendorf. One only hopes. But there's one guy who just, the process starts and it obviously freaks him out. But it's so striking, the degree to which people don't do that. And it's not just that it's not at all that it's been edited down, because these are long, long, long shots. But you do see things when it's close up enough. Like there's a blonde young man in this who, when they start pouring materials on him, you can see him gagging over and over and over again. And he keeps his mouth closed, and he's so dutiful. And that, for me, is just so the other side of the disciplinary coin, right? I mean, and it's quite, I mean, there is, on the one hand, this conceit of the body as the originary site of art and of the social, but it's a conceit that completely disavows the possibility that the body is that automatically. I mean, it's so totally committed to Nietzsche's authorial intentions and scripting. I mean, one of the things that Hal and I were talking about earlier is how literary this is as a project. And you've seen probably the reproduction of the sort of planning and mapping of the six-day play. And that, for me, was offset by meeting Nietzsche. I mean, I told Hal that, you know, I had all these ideas about that certain sort of overbearing aspects of the scriptedness made him meet him, and he's like the nicest guy in the world. But there, I mean, I also think it's something that people obviously very willingly subject themselves to. And that, too, is something that I feel a wish that the works would explore, the sort of conditions of subjugation of its performers a little bit more. I mean, I think all of this is actually significantly more complicated in the early stuff, where it's Nietzsche doing these things, and there's so much affect, there's so much anger, there's just so much going on in him and around him as a performer. I find it, when it actually becomes theater, much less interesting. It's as though these sort of problems that are very vivid in the early 60s become, you know, less problematic for him.
I don't know, maybe we should open up, but I wonder if you want to say anything about the next demi-generation. I mean, there's the way in which, as figures like Valley Export emerge, the question of participation, the question of audience, the question of social space, public space, is very different, because she immediately opens up the question of gender and difference. We talked about this extraordinary performance that she did, 1968?
68 or 69,
yeah. Gilded Year, where she, I mean, many of you may know, it was called the Pat and Paw Cinema, and she just took a box, a brown, you know, cardboard box, and walked through the streets of Vienna, and she opened up two holes in this box, and she was bare underneath, and invited men, I think, to fondle her. And obviously I wasn't there, I've only seen it in terms of documentary photographs, but she has this kind of almost mock, dumb visage, which seems almost made up in this blanked out way.
So, I mean, she has a kind of mother's little helper look,
yeah,
too, like kind of Valium.
And it's not
that I would know.
You know, kind of the easy participation of others is immediately put into question, and I think that this is true of other women who become involved in body art. I mean, it's famous Yoko Ono cut piece, where she sits before an audience and invites them to cut away her clothing. I mean, clearly this kind of ambivalence, that kind of anxiety, is put into play by men as well. I mean, it's the bread and butter of Bakanchi in some ways. But I agree with you, that does seem to be absent in his work, but then put into play by people who want to develop it, but to question it as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think he was a huge part of making the body available as a site, and not kind of a sort of coding of action as something that would sort of rest on and stay with the body in the in the early days. And I think that the insistence on mediation in someone like Valley Export is a kind of step that she takes that comes out of actionism, but that is also a critique of it. I mean, I think it is, it's a critique of the implicit authorial stance in the work of somebody like Nietzsche, and a critique...
Somebody, so much of her work, her body is almost wants to disappear in the
I mean, I think you're right that her face is made... I mean, she... there's, and I mean, I also think it's very obviously a performance, what she's doing. And, I mean, I always... Does it have two holes in it, the box? Because I think I have an idea. I'm sure I'm wrong, but I think it's a... There's a reason why I have this fantasy. I imagine that... I always imagine that box as a kind of proscenium. So I actually thought it had a... some kind of a curtain, but that's not at all to say that it actually does. But I do think that part of the presentation there is as though it's a stage, you know, that you're reaching into this. I mean, also because she calls it a cinema, doesn't she? So it's the idea that the cinema, you know, it's the cinema without projection, right? It's the peep show where you get to, you know, it's in some sense. Like everything the Etant Donné isn't. It's the peep show where you get to use your hands. And so it's a kind of insistence on making people aware of mediation by offering a kind of actualized fantasy of the unmediated, but calling it mediation, right? Yeah. Calling it the cinema. Pat and Paw is... Did Benjamin translate it that way? It's good. It's Tastenpachtkino, which is not—it is not quite as sort of juicy and colloquial. But it's—I mean, it's actually—it's—it's it's kind of—it's dry. But I like Pat and Paul.
Should we open it up to you all?